Romeo, India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the check that on my mark. Sorry, I'm a little bit late. Mr. S.H.O., I think you wanted to say something to me before we start. Go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Just wanted to pass the word. I mean, in case there are any issues, you know who to blame, who to yell at, who to find. I put my IRLP note up on a local repeater here, the WB3EHB machine, which is somewhere around Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And that should be all set up just fine. Typically we know what we're doing here, but in case we should run into anything strange, please let me know. I will be monitoring, keeping an eye on this all night. So an announcement for the locals and for those up there in Long Island. You will be having a pretty nice footprint in an area around South Jersey this evening. This is KC2SHO. Thank you.
Very fine. Thank you for that, John. Okay. For those who haven't heard of the TechNet, hopefully there's very few of you guys, but there's always new people joining. It's kind of surprising to me after 33 years that people haven't heard of the TechNet and suddenly find out about it. So I give a little bit of an introduction. What is it? It's a gathering of curious amateur radio operators that want to know more about how radio equipment works. What's the best way to get the best performance out of their transmitters and their receivers and their antennas and their feed lines and propagation and the question of the 27 different kinds of ham radio. Lots of different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the kinds. So these people gather on Sunday night in this gathering of three or four people. John, KC2WGB, K2RAW, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, and occasionally we hear from Al, K6DPZ. We discuss these issues. We dropped. In our very loose menu is that during the first hour, we take check-ins and questions of a general nature. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, dipping into the mailbag. And the mailbag represents people who don't yet have their amateur license or don't have the right equipment to talk to us directly. And by various means, they send him a communication with some very exciting questions from time to time. And we discuss two, three, or four of those, the ones that have general interest, what we believe have general interest, which John selects with that criteria. That's followed by Paul, a WS2N, our space expert, which tonight Paul will be giving us a SpaceX space report number 169. And and NASA's always doing some darn interesting things. John also, KC2WGB, monitors the email, the Echo link, so that if we're too quick on the trigger, you don't get a chance to sign in. John knows about it, and there's various ways you can send him a message, making sure that you get your edge in word-wise, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. We take check-ins of people who do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in to say you're listening. After 33 years, the TechNet began September of 1982, 33 years ago. And this is TechNet number 1576, if I'm counting correctly. And so by now we believe people are listening by way of Echolink and IRLP. Occasionally people sign in from other countries, other states, and so on. Okay, we'll get rolling. If you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and your name at this time. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me your check-ins if you've got a question or a comment. K2RIW, listening.
And 2EL with a question, Dick.
Steve, and yes. WHYY, Joe, yes.
Okay, I heard EO, Steve, and Joe, RYY. Steve, give me your call letters.
82
Okay, you got covered up a little bit. I think it was KD2HUC, Hotel Uniform Charlie. Do I have the correct start, Steve?
Yes, that's correct, Dick.
Okay, we've got Rich, Steve, and Joe in that order. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2SHO with an additional comment, Dick, if I could, just before we start.
Okay, go ahead, John. KC2SHO, go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick. My only comment might be, since it's the first night we're doing this down here in South New Jersey, if people could just be a little extra careful about the long runs and the run-ons where the repeater does not release, which also causes the RLP to not release. I'll be here monitoring so I can always reconnect and do that, but just a little request. Thank you again. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Hey, Brian John, you sound pretty good from Mount Laurel, New Jersey, tonight. And if you go to KC2SHO at QRZ.com, you'll see a beautiful picture of John's shack and other pieces of equipment. So, I think you're going to take up ham radio as a hobby. That's a joke. Okay. Let's see, the first person on our list tonight was Rich and 2EO. Go right ahead, Rich. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the TechNet. How copy, Dick?
Copy good, Rich. Please proceed.
Okay, Dick. What I wanted to talk about is wheelchair mobile. I know I brought this up a long time ago. I'm getting a hub around. I don't know if you saw it on TV. It's spelled H-O-V-E-R-O-U-N-D. One R. Took me about a year to get it through Medicare. They're very, very picky because they're expensive. Anyway, my doctor told me I'm going to get it in about 2 to 3 weeks. They're going to deliver it. I want to go wheelchair mobile. It has another, my question is, it has two batteries, two 12-volt batteries in the series. The 24-volt, so what I want to be, you know, total 24 volts, I would like power this thing at 12 volts. My question is, and we discussed this a year ago, but I don't remember what was said, can I power it? Can I use one battery, across one battery, to power like a 51 mobile rig? Or is that going to totally imbalance the system? And I'll have to talk to Hub around when they deliver it. I don't want to void my warranty on the thing. So, back to you, Dick.
Now, you're going to get a lot of opinions on this one, Rich. And you're in a somewhat unconventional area. The two batteries that are in series on your hub around your electronically powered wheelchair, the most important thing that's required when you got two batteries in series is that they both at every instant of time be equally charged. Same voltage, same current, same number of ampere hours in each battery. And if one battery should go dead before the other, when you got two batteries in series, that's an extremely dangerous is not quite the right word, but let's say it's a very undesirable situation. The battery that's still cranking will be drawing current into the battery that has just gone discharged, and it will reverse charge that one. It'll start seeing a reverse polarity. In the case of a vast number of batteries, nickel cadmium, lead acid in particular, you reverse charge a battery and terrible things happen as far as the battery life is concerned. If you are putting a lightly draining device, you're hearing a bunch of opinions from me right now. Let me drop. If you're putting a lightly draining device, a light drain, like a handy talkie, which only draws a couple of watts across one battery, I wouldn't worry about it. But when it comes to a 100-watt rig, which when you're transmitting is drawing 20 amperes, that's a heavy discharge on one battery compared to the other battery. And I guess there are ways of very intelligently flipping back and forth with a complicated switching circuitry. You discharge battery number one for a while and discharge battery number two for a while. So the bottom line of all this is that's kind of complicated. There's a zillion ways that can go wrong. My strongest recommendation, if you really want to run 50 or 100 watt HF rig from a battery, it should be a completely separate battery from the two batteries that are in series that operate the wheelchair. So you don't develop an unbalanced condition. That's my opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with that. And yes, to carry a third battery is a bit inconvenient. The third battery plus the 100-watt rig plus the antennas. It's not easy. But So for heavy drains on only one of the two batteries, I don't recommend it. Let me drop. There is one other solution. And that is an inverter circuit. Ordinarily, an inverter circuit starts off with 12 volts and builds it up to a higher voltage. And what's not very well known is an inverter circuit can go either way. If your inverter circuit took the buck regulator, let's go, that's one way of looking at a buck regulator, but it's kind of an inverter circuit. So it's an oscillating circuit, whether it be doing individual pulses or real back and forth oscillation, where there's a primary winding with more turns and a secondary winding with less turns, because you only want 12 volts out with 24 volts in. It's a bit rare, but there's definitely a kind of a circuit you can buy that, with reasonably high efficiency, will take 24 in and give 13.7 out. And now you'd be discharging both batteries simultaneously. Eric, how often have you seen an inverter-like circuit, a buck regulator, taking 24 in, giving 13.7 out, doing it efficiently? My guess is that's a very small percentage of the kind of regulators we can buy. But do you know of a brand name? Do you know of a price? Do you know of an efficiency? Got any information on that one at all? KE2EJ, K2LIW, the TechNet. You got it, Eric.
HUC with a comment.
Can you hear me, Dick? I'm hearing you fine. I'm going to take you first and then HUC in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. The commercial world, there's lots of them available at $50,000 price range. I've built a bunch of them. Actually, I just built another. I started with 24 volts. Now, if you're building it, it's quite simple with the chips that are out there. I just got the electric diodes. As far as the ham world goes, I haven't really seen anything that's priced. So, talking about an HF radio, you're talking about a lot of juice. 20 amp, just cover. About all I can tell you, K2IWK,
VHF, UHF, Dick.
Yeah, but still, you're not powering a handy talkie. You're powering a real base station rig, which can, in theory, draw a fair amount of current. Although they're expensive, the commercial ones, just for us to get a handle on that one, Eric, roughly how many bucks are the commercial ones at the, let me pick a number, the 100-watt level, 24 volts in, 13 volts out? If you happen to know, are we talking about $500 worth by commercial standards? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
100 watts, producing, I think, anything in from 12 volts to 5 volts to 40 volts. I'm looking 100 watts, probably like 350 in that neighborhood.
You're very fine, Eric. That's a good calibration point. Steve, KD2HUC, are you familiar with these circuits? And if so, please tell us a brand name and a model number. Or do you have another solution to the problem? KD2HUC. K2LIW, you got it, Steve.
I actually do it, Dick. The company that I use is Phoenix Contact. And depending upon the wattage, you know, Eric is about like, $200 to $300, depending upon what you do. They have a brick input. I use 130 volts DC in for 24 volts out. But they come in various flavors, including 12 volts and 48 volts. For all kinds of different industry stuff. And they're relatively efficient and they're small. They're actually made to mount on a 35mm DIN rail. They're self-regulated and actually quite nice. Should work very well for them. Again, that company's Phoenix Contact. You'll have to go online to get a model number because I don't use any 12-volt stuff. 82HUC, back to you.
Okay, yeah. Steve, you called it Felix Contact. Is that F-E-L-I-X Contact? Is that the brand name that you're discussing?
No, it's Phoenix, like Phoenix, Arizona. Phoenix Contact.
Okay, Phoenix, P-H-O-E-N-I-X, like the city in Arizona. Is that the way Phoenix is spelled?
That is correct. I believe, I want to say the model name is called Quint, but my memory is, not what it used to be, but I want to say that the model name that Phoenix uses is, you know, the Quint series. And they're actually really nice power supplies. You can parallel them if needed, you know, depending upon your use. They even have a, you know, I mean, obviously not for a wheelchair, but if you're using it for any sort of ham radio and you wanted to do a redundant installation, they even have blocking diodes in a nice little package with a heat sink so that the failure of one supply won't take down the other. Some nice equipment they offer.
K2UPS has a comment, Dick.
Okay, let's see what Rich has got to say. K2UPS, probably mobile. Probably in West Virginia or Pennsylvania. So, a quick word as to where you are and how you would solve this problem, Rich. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. Mobile, K2 RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Well, you don't worry about voiding warranties or anything. Doesn't have to be a lead acid battery that's heavy. I mean, you can get a hobby battery or something that they use for some of the remote control planes. Very lightweight, but they're a little on the pricey side. But if you're going to try to do that, there is a website or a page called InverterSupply.com. InverterSupply.com. They got all different inverters for all different voltages. A quick look, there's a company called Samlex, S-A-M-L-E-X. They make really good inverters. It's not cheap. I think they're selling it for $73, but it will take 24 volts down to a regulated, anywhere like between 12 and 15. You can set it at 13.8 so that radio will be real happy. It'll handle 20 amps, I believe, also. That's what it's rated at. But InverterSupply.com, you probably find just what you're looking for there. Come back to that.
Very fine, Rich. That's some good information. The first 15 seconds of what you were saying, I think got clipped off because of all of the resetting of all the repeaters along the line between us and wherever you are, which we didn't hear. But InverterSupply.com. So it sounds like a darn good company. And you did, I think, also mention the fact that there are lithium-ion type batteries, which have extremely high energy density, relatively light, the ones that are being used on radio-controlled electronic model airplanes and cars. Lots and lots of energy density in the small package. Medium price if you buy them from the radio-control market. You can get a lot of ampere hours for not very many dollars, because the guys that fly model airplanes are not willing to spend $1,000 for a battery. And so they get a lot of battery for the money. That's the good news. Compact, high energy, not too expensive. The bad news is lithium ion batteries have got some pretty nasty failure mechanisms. If something shorts out that battery and there isn't a protection circuit in it, or even when it's being charged, every one of these radio-controlled model airplane enthusiasts are being told, at least at the events that are authorized by the Academy of Model Aeronautics, AMA, you must put that lithium battery into a steel container, call it a jerry can, if you like, while it's being charged, just in case if something funny happens, shrapnel is not going to be spread around the property. So charging those and discharging them is something you have to be a little bit careful of. The portable handheld batteries, let me drop the call. You'll see lots of people walking around supermarkets with a handheld device that does barcode scanning and whatever. Motorola and Thimble are some of the very big brand names on those things. Well, if you study that actual battery that's in there, it's a lithium ion battery, or lithium polymer battery, I'm not sure which, into each and every battery is built a protection circuit that stops you from overcharging it too many volts, overcharging it at too much current, or discharging it at too much current. There's a protection circuit in there, and therefore very few of those batteries experience failure. That's the good news. The bad news of these batteries you buy for radio-controlled model airplanes do not contain that protection circuit in general. so if you choose that approach. So you've got a couple of things to consider here, the way as I see it, Rich. There's various kinds of third batteries you could be using to run your equipment. There's a lot of desirable characteristics for that, because if at worst you run down that battery and you still got a handy talkie where you can holler mayday, then you're not stopping the movement of the chair, and you're not unbalancing the batteries of the chair. The other approach is the inverter that takes the whole 24 volts, and live with the fact you've got less life with the battery in the chair because you've now got two separate drains. Let me drop. And there's one other thing you've got to be a little bit careful of here, Rich, and that is, although it's unlikely, you run an HF rig with more than a couple of watts, and it's only a couple of feet away from all of the controls of the chair. Although it's unlikely, it has happened. RF energy picked up by that circuitry can false alarm it, and the circuitry can think that you have just demanded full blast forward velocity, or full blast reverse velocity, if you know what I mean. So a relatively exhaustive test should be conducted to make sure that the electromagnetic compatibility, the electromagnetic interference between your medium power or high power ham radio equipment and the controls of the chair are compatible. Because I've heard of a number of stories of where a go-kart, for instance, or a golfing cart, when in the presence of a transmitter, can go crazy. So definitely consider that. So we haven't given you a nice, exact answer here, Rich. We've got a fairly deep, complicated problem, but at least you now know a couple of approaches to attacking it. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Bad golf, Zulu.
Let's see now. Bill, give us your words on this one. Mr. QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just a little bit to back up your thoughts about the one battery using an issue. At a previous place I worked, we had a whole bunch of 48-volt plants, and we had one particular piece of 12-volt equipment. And some guys did it the right way with a DC converter and ran the 12-volt device, and everything was fine. It was 48-volt plant, just off a breaker position. Some guys cheesed out, maybe in 20% of the location, and just put the 12-volt device across one of the four batteries in one of the strings. So typically I had four 48-volt strings made up of four 12-volt batteries each. Invariably, every single battery that had the 12-volt device on it wasn't necessarily high current, but, you know, amper 2, maybe 3, not a lot, but every single battery that had that 12-volt device on it directly across one of the cells, that cell suffered some sort of infant mortality and had less than half the life of the other batteries. So it's just a real-life experience with you know, your thoughts. WB2QGZ.
Yeah, thank you for that, Bill. So, as I've said before, and as Bill has experienced with the cell sites that he has worked at, when you've got a number of batteries in series, keeping them balanced is extremely important. And so anything you do that loads down one of those series cells really is verboten, unless you're doing it at just a few milliamps. Don't do it. And so either discharge the whole darn thing through an inverter, or go out and buy a third battery, so to speak, for this particular application. But do also have somebody run a pretty thorough test of all possible frequencies, all possible powers, to make sure that no electromagnetic interference can happen to the controls of the chair, where the chair thinks it's got a false alarm of a full blast forward just because you're transmitting on 20 meters. N2EO, K2RIW and TechNet. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark. And to hear, well, I got what people said. What you said, Dick, also, thank you very much. I wasn't sure, but I think you did say a year ago that the one balanced the two batteries. I think West Mountain Radio, they make an inverter. I have to check the price. I have to call them and check the price. Maybe I can find it online. I was hoping to go across one battery and avoid the cost. No, it's not an HF, just a 2 meter 440 rig, and I'll talk to you next week maybe about it. I want to mount a small, not too high, because when I go into stores, I don't want to clip it on the ceiling or anything, or going in the, on the top of the door. But I want to put a small mobile whip antenna for 2 meter 440, and I'll check. It's probably, when I get the chair in another couple of weeks, it's probably got metal, so that would be a good ground plane. I'll have to figure out how to mount it. Anyway, Dick, thank you very much. I will call West Mountain Radio this week and see what they got to say. Who knows, maybe they've had experience with a hot around. You never know. Back to net and to Leo.
2MU.
Okay, we heard 2MU. Give us your full call, your name, and your comments, sir. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. This is K2MU. Bernie, I'm on my HT. I just wanted to throw this in real quick to Rich. Please consider doing HF from that hub around. I think that would be really cool, working DX, and you could definitely work out some kind of whip antenna. Do like 10, 20, or 40 from your hub around. That's all I have to say. This is Bernie in Bayside. Back to net control.
Yeah, very kind, Bernie. And when it comes to Rich's first requirement, 2 meters and 440, whether or not the wheelchair is used as a ground, almost as about irrelevant as I see it, Rich. Choose the right antenna. There are antennas where within the antenna it's balanced and it doesn't require current flowing in the ground for the antenna to work well. That's the best kind of antenna, in my opinion, for you to use in this application. Lots and lots of people think that if an antenna is not well grounded, it's not going to work well. And there's a yes and a no to that. Choose the right kind of an antenna which within the radiator itself is a half wavelength radiator. That antenna could be being held in the hand of an astronaut who's in who's floating in free space behind the space shuttle, and the antenna will work like a charm. The word ground is highly misunderstood in this particular area. Okay, so Rich is going to be reporting to us from time to time as he researches this one. Steve is next. KD2HUC. Go ahead with your question, Steve. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. Dick, I just wanted to touch on something that we were discussing a couple of weeks ago with regards to lightning protection and grounding and such. One of the recommendations that John had offered was to sink a ground rod right where the cables enter and not have it come into the house, which I'd agree with. My comment is that as I was working through this and looking at it, one of the imperative things that I don't think we mentioned was that if you do sink a ground rod for lightning protection for your radio, it is absolutely imperative that you bond it to the whatever ground rod is, grounding your electrical equipment. You can't rely on any other path, because you really need to make sure that there's no potential difference between the rod that's protecting your antennas and the rod that's protecting your electrical system, because in the event of a strike or a fault, it could do a lot of damage.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. Through the ground, you're going to have some number of ohms you can measure with the right kind of equipment. If you had a real good grounding rod, its resistance to the rest of Mother Earth might be, let me pick a number, 3 ohms. And if you happen to...
stand at 25 milliohms a foot.
Okay. If I sink 2 8-foot long, 5/8 diameter, EIA standard copper clad grounding rods in my property, one on the north side of my property, one on the south side of my property, and now with a wire between the two with the right kind of instrumentation, I measure the ground ohms of resistance between those two grounding rods. Be a guess, Eric, as to what you think I will measure. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now that's an interesting question, because it all depends upon the geography of the ground that you have, geology, not geography, right? It could be anywhere from less than an ohm to maybe 10, 15 ohms. And if the ground is saturated with water, it'll be less. And if it's dry, it'll be more. And there actually is a method to grounding things properly and bonding it all together so that will not only take the path of least resistance, but will also not have the difference of potential at the point where you have created your ground system. A lot of people get into trouble if they think, just take a piece of wire, bond this to that, and ta-da, it's grounded. And they forget that the wire itself has resistance. Teacher IWC,
yeah.
WBC,
NEC,
the
requirement for protection of electrical equipment is 25 ohms to ground or less. So, keeping in mind that the NEC is looking to trip overcurrent devices, you know, the grounding system for the electrical system is not designed, those requirements are not designed for lightning protection. They're designed to ensure that overcurrent protection is tripped during a ground fault situation.
Yeah, we had a triple that time, and everybody was unidentified, but still, good information. Of all of the geology that Eric was discussing, anything from slightly less than one ohm to quite a few ohms is possible. With two ground rods, a good number of feet apart, and those ground rods are well installed in moderately good soil. Let me take the bottom of that list, one ohm. I can easily get one ohm between two very well installed grounding rods on very good, medium conducting, very well conducting soil. I can easily get an ohm. Medium-sized lightning bolt is 11,000 amperes. 11,000 amperes into the grounding system that goes into grounding rod number one versus grounding rod number two. One ohm at 11,000 amperes means that there will be a voltage drop between those two grounding rods of 11,000 volts. Now, there's 11,000 volt potential difference between various pieces of electronics in your house. I know you're going to be unhappy. If you take a look at the book recommending grounding techniques and lightning protection by Polyphase, Polyphase has got a very nice, I'm going to guess it's a 50-page book telling you almost everything you want to know or don't want to know about lightning. Let me drop it. They will show you various diagrams by which you rewire the grounding of your power panel going into the house versus the ham equipment and so on. There are ways that you can create a common point grounding so that now you don't have two separate grounding rods some number of feet apart bridging the electronics in your house, the ham equipment versus everything else, where you could, in my example, get 11,000 volts. So this is not an easy one. To wire things correctly, it looks a little bit illogical at first, where you're using extra wire, so to speak. But if there's only one point in the ground where the system is being grounded, it can be a hell of a lot safer. And multiple grounding points, unless you're going to create a great big mat of grounding. To the A1 MBA, who lives on top of a granite mountain in Massachusetts, he chose a high mountain because he's a VHF operator. Let me drop him. In order for WA1 MBA, Tom Williams, in order for him to create the proper kind of grounding for lightning protection, he literally had to lay down a copper mat, so to speak, a whole bunch of fairly heavy gauge copper cables, like a raster scan across his property, some of them going from east to west and some of them going from north to south, all bound together, because the granite he was living on gives very poor grounding. And even with all of that effort for grounding his tower, his ham radio equipment, and the stuff in the house, he still had equipment failures when the lightning did strike him. So lightning is pretty tough. The good news is very few of us are in an environment where you're going to be struck often. You would think with me almost 300 feet above sea level in Huntington with 100 feet of tower, you would think I'm going to be struck every single thunderstorm. I've been here for 45 years, and there was a strike one block away from me, not a direct strike to the tower, which gave me quite a bit of grief, in meaning that none of the ham radio equipment got damaged, but much of the computing equipment and internet connection equipment did get damaged. So, 8-foot come in on light bounding. It's a tough one. But as I said, that Polyphase book from the Polyphase company, it used to be around $20. I don't know what it is right now. Gives you a lot of good information. K2IW listening.
KD2HUC. Look, a couple of things as well. Let me drop and make sure I'm not getting stepped on. First, what I was saying before is, in your example, you were using one ohm differential between points. Keeping in mind that the grounding system for residents, the requirements here in New York are a minimum of 25 ohms. So that means that when they sink a ground rod into your property to ground your service equipment, as long as when it's tested it has 25 ohms or less, it's considered acceptable and that's where it's left. So as you can imagine, 25 ohms as far as lightning protection goes is, well, probably the protection is non-existent. Let me drop. The whole point of the grounding system, you know, Article 250 in the NEC, the size of the grounding conductors, is all there to ensure that overcurrent devices work correctly when there's a phase to ground stress in the electrical system. So that's it. Certainly not designed to protect the antenna systems. That said, one of the things you had said is, even, you know, if you develop a common point grounding system, that works very well, but everybody seems to forget that grounded neutral. The neutral that comes into most residences is grounded at the transformer. Now, unless you live in the middle of nowhere where you have your own transformer, that transformer may be several blocks away, and quite a potential difference can develop going out that neutral. It's probably the reason why during your strike, when it struck in the neighborhood, your computer equipment was damaged, but your radio equipment wasn't. The isolation transformers in most power supplies is enough to allow, you know, to block that potential difference of current from flowing. Let me drop. As the computer if it's sitting in the shack and tied together and whatnot to the grounding system, well, it has a, you know, direct path between the grounding system and that neutral. And, well, I don't need to tell you what happens with that. If you are going to do a counterpoint grounding system, then an isolation transformer is a very good investment. I've used them with a multitude of success. Simple 120 to 120, you redirect the neutral and it gets grounded to your common point of grounding for the lightning protection. This way everything is at the same potential. During an event, the potential comes up together and goes back down together, and there's no threat current flowing around your system. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, the fact that the code will let you have a significant number of ohms to a grounding system really indicates that that code is intended for human safety. We ground for three reasons: human safety first, lightning protection second, and what we think is better operation of certain kinds of antennas work better with the ground nearby. But that first one, human safety, is the one that occurs day in and day out. You may think that lightning is going to look at the wires you've got up in the air and the tower you've got, and it's going to say, aha, there's high metal and that's where I'm going to go. You'd be amazed how infrequent lightning is with a direct strike to your ham radio equipment. Unless you live where Tom Williams did, WA1MBA, he's on top of this multiple thousand foot mountain in Massachusetts, and it's a poorly grounded mountain with a lot of granite around, and he was the tallest thing around for miles. He did get struck once every couple of years, and for him it was quite a bit of grief. But that's an unusual situation. Not many of us live in that environment. If you looked at your particular environment from a lightning point of view, and you see all of that wiring of all of those utility poles every 150 feet up and down every single one of our residential streets, and all of that wiring and all of those trees and whatever, your ham radio, your shiny ham radio equipment, let me drop, where you lose a lot of sleep at night thinking that your shiny ham radio equipment is a real good target for lightning, it's probably a once per 50 year event that is going to be a near strike to your property, if you know what I mean. So the human protection grounding is number one for your ground fault interrupter system to work correctly and to make sure you're not electrocuted. And so that's a much lighter requirement than the common point grounding, the fancy wiring for common point grounding to give you the most amount of protection for lightning. And I say the most amount of protection for lightning, no matter what you do. If you lived in Gainesville, Florida, the lightning capital on planet Earth on the eastern, on the western hemisphere, where every other thunderstorm you're going to get quite a few lightning strikes, no matter what you do, all that you use, all the protection devices you can think of, you're still going to periodically get damage, because the 11,000 amperes is an average lightning strike. Once in a while, you're going to get positive cloud lightning instead of negative cloud lightning, where some of those strikes will hit over 100,000 amperes. All the protection in the world, not the magnetic bolts. In other words, in that lightning bolt with 100,000 amperes, even though it strikes a half a block away from you, the strong amount of magnetic field it creates is going to create a voltage potential across every conductor in that environment. And so you're going to get some grief out of that one. You put the best possible lock on the door of your house, and you think you're going to keep out all burglars. You're going to keep out 99% of them. But if a man is hell-bent on getting into your house, if there's smoke coming out of your house and you're not home, and a fireman sees that, if he's got to drill a hole in the wall, he's going to get into your house to stop that source of smoke, if you know what I mean. So lightning protection and the world's best locks are a strong deterrent. But you're going to have to admit they're not perfect. There is no perfect protection from lightning. Do all the right things by reading the Polyphaser book. It'll give you a hell of a lot more chance of not getting equipment damage. But accept the fact that occasionally it's going to occur no matter what the heck you do. So grounding for human protection, do all of that. But if you think it's going to give you perfect lightning protection, not necessarily so. And with any further comments on all of this, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Question and comment, Melvin.
Okay, I heard question and comment. I heard EJ first. Eric first, go right ahead, Eric. And Eric, give us a little more audio.
All right, just waiting for this. Let's carry it. The site you want to go to is www.smithpower.com. They actually make the polyphaser stuff. And go to the media library, and you can read or ground rod theory, dissimilar metal theory, how to place the ground rod, literature on flaws being applied to ground systems, etc., so on and so forth. The other question I have for you is, can you transmit down at 420? Question. K2RIW, K2J.
My particular Kenwood transmitter goes down to 430 and up to 450. No, it does not cover. To my knowledge, it does not cover 420 to 430. Eric, go ahead.
As do most, but now you can figure out why. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, my 450 rig is a Kenwood 851. My 2-meter rig is a Kenwood 811. Kenwood 811 is my 450, and Kenwood 711A is my 2-meter rig. But the 450 rig, to my knowledge, does not cover 420 to 430. It does cover 430 to 450, all mode. Okay, you said schmidtpower.com. Spell that Schmidt, the first word on that, before power. Please spell that for us, Eric. Go ahead.
Okay.
Whoever
is on IO. Don't have the BG microphone. It's not set up right. What's happening is actually hanging up stuff as we drop. Site is www, if you choose, and Smith Power, that's Sierra, Mary, India, Thomas, Henry, Sierra, is in Peter, O is in Ocean, W is in Watt, E is in Edward, R is in radio.com.
Okay, glad I asked you. Because your audio is a little bit low, and I wasn't sure what you were saying, Smith, Schmidt, and so on. I'm glad you spelled it. S-M-I-T-H-S, smithspower.com. Okay, and he's going to give us a lot of the information that's in the Polyphaser book, and we don't have to spend the $25 or $30. In fact, the Polyphaser book is probably now online, and there's various ways we can get that lightning protection information. Now, there was another person who wanted to give us some information. That person identify themselves with their call letters and name. Do that right now. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Joe, Delta
2.
R-O. And the comment in question is, all the residential
KD2AMZ, Mike with a comment.
Okay, we got Mike, but Joe was first. We heard Joe with some dropouts. Joe, blank, 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 R-O, and then a bunch of blanks after that. So unfortunately, I want to give it one more time, one more attempt, Joe, with all those dropouts. We didn't get your full call, and we didn't get your information. Joe, blank, blank, R-O, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, WB2HRO, you copy now?
Okay, now I copy WB2HRO. Go right ahead, Joe.
Yes, in virtually every residential electrical installation where the electric line comes into the premises, whether it's a 1, 2, 3, 4 family house, doesn't matter, the service line, the neutral, is grounded to either a grounding rod or to a cold water pipe that is metal. And usually with fairly substantial wire, 8 gauge or heavier. And that's the case to opens up, you still don't burn out everything in your house due to the fact that the line is unbalanced and so the is tight. So that's a standard thing. I've seen it in the city or outside the city, so I think all houses are done that way, or should be.
Yeah, I think you're right, Joe, that many older houses, the majority of the grounding at the house is by way of a cold water pipe. I think the code these days wants you to have an auxiliary grounding rod outside the house as close as possible to the service entrance. And the main, and all of that grounding at the residence is a backup ground. The primary ground for the pole pig transformer is supposed to be the butt plate that the metallic plate that's on the bottom of the utility pole underground, and a piece of 8-gauge wire going up that that wooden round object going up the side of the pole that's supposed to be grounding the case of your local pole pig transformer that steps your 2300 volts or 13 kilovolts, whatever it is, down to your 240 with center tap of those three wires that come to your house. So that's the main ground that's supposed to be there. But in my particular case, for instance, a number of utility poles here get hit with automobiles. Sometimes that butt plate grounding system is not reestablished. And now the only grounding for the pole pig transformer is the grounding at the individual residences. And yes, there have been cases of where a naive plumber wants to replace the main water valve, cutter valve coming into your house, and he unsolders those two pieces of pipe to replace that valve, and he's got one hand across each pipe as he pulls it across, and that was doing the grounding for the pole pig transformer out front, and between his two hands a few thousand volts appears. And so there are plumbers who have lost their life over that situation. A smart plumber will measure with his clamp-on ammeter to find out if there's any current flowing in that water pipe that he's about to disconnect, and to be double-darn sure, he will also put two great big jumper cables between those two pipes before he separates them, and maybe beyond that he's wearing rubber gloves, if you know what I mean. So the way we bring power into our house and the way that grounding works, and whether or not that primary voltage, you've got three high-tension lines doing distribution down your block. Maybe they're three-phase, 2300, and one of those lines goes into your particular power pig, pole pig transformer, and the grounding of that transformer completes that circuit. And so if your particular utility pole doesn't have that grounding wire there, And if somebody interrupts the grounding in your house because he's replacing that water valve, all of a sudden that 2300 volts appears in your house, and that ain't good. So you got to be careful with these. If we have any further comments or questions on this subject of grounding, K2RIW and the TechNet.
BGB, would you comment?
Hey, Dick, it's actually required to put a permanent jumper around water meters and water main valves on new installations.
Okay. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead. I'll bet you the standards there in Staten Island are fairly strict on this one. Is that true, John?
KC2AM, view for comment.
First, Mike. Wait a minute. When it comes to your concrete wall, that's where the ground clip gets put on there. You don't put it after the valve. That's no-no. Water meters, yes, they have jumpers across them because sometimes they were an addition to somebody who didn't have a water meter and there was no other way to do it, then you'll see the Bondi jumper across it. But where the difficulty comes in is when you have the T-valves out in the sidewalk or out in the street where they can shut your water off. When the plumber has to replace that or the city replaces that, they definitely have to put a jumper on there because when that pipe is cut, even though the rest of it is still underground, there a voltage appears on there. Many people have been hurt there. Not so much in the house, though. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, thank you for that information, John. KD2AMZ, go right ahead, Mike. K2RIW, the tech man.
KD2AMZ, Mike, Woodbridge, Virginia, via Echo. Like, yes, Dick, you're absolutely correct. The primary ground is the utility ground. All the internal grounds are also... their subground. People also make a huge mistake by taking the ground and the neutral bus, tying them together. I see that all the time. Not good. And in regards to EMP and lightning protection, well, yes, you can protect her, but it's very, very extreme. It's called the steel room. I see them quite often. And a steel room is exactly what the name implies. It is a steel box, completely hermetically sealed. All the pipe and any utility entrances are welded tight and it's verified. All water connections have a dielectric insulator between them. The doors are double door airlocks. The two doors are never open at the same time. Obviously, this is for rather severe EMP, basically an atomic bomb. But the principle is the same. So, and all the utilities that enter the steel room are through filters. And those filters do take a beating. We had a couple blow up on us, actually. But you can protect from lightning and EMP, but it's extreme, extreme, extreme. And in places of granite mountains, what they do is they actually run a ground grid of cables down the side of a mountain. So you literally have a screen of heavy cables to supply the ground for, like, the mountaintop installation. I've seen a lot of those in the field. So that's how they solve the problem. But we're talking, well, millions and millions of dollars. But you can protect from lightning and or EMP to a pretty good extent. So it really can be done, but we're talking, like, government, military-type installations. But it's very doable. Just going to cost you a few million. That's my comment. Thank you, Dick.
Thank you for the information, Mike. And now, our next person was Joe, WB2HRO. Go right ahead with your information, Joe. K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2RIW and the TechNet, WB2HRO. So, now I gather that the primary on the pole transformer, the circuit is made through the ground. In other words, one side of the primary goes to the overhead 2300 volts or whatever, and the other side of the coil goes to earth ground. There's no neutral wire up top. Over.
You got it, Joe. That's the bad news. You'd like to think that each individual pole pig transformer has its own grounding lead. Most of your utility poles do have a one high wire in the center, which is for lightning protection, and it periodically has a wire running down a utility pole to a butt plate, but it does not connect to the individual pole peak transformers. You do have a phase A, phase B, and phase C 2300 volt wiring, for instance, on many residential areas for distribution.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Alaska Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
So as I said, there's three phases going down the block, phase A, B, and C, each 2300 volts or 13 kilovolts, numbers like this, each phase to ground. And one of those phases goes into that great big porcelain insulated lead on your particular pole peak transformer. That goes into the primary, one lead of the primary. The other end of that primary is the case of the pole peak transformer, which must be grounded for safety reasons with a piece of, I think it's 8 gauge wire running down the utility pole to the butt plate, this metallic plate that's on the bottom of the utility pole before it's installed in the ground. That's the primary ground. And you'd be amazed how many utility poles have a pole peak transformer where that piece of wire going down the pole is not there. And therefore, the completion of the primary circuit of that pole peak transformer takes place in your house. And if for any reason that grounding lead of your house is in the third wire of your house becomes interrupted to a real good earth ground like your water pipe and or another grounding rod, which should be there, in many houses is not, that gets interrupted.
Welcome
then,
to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
As I was starting to say, that circuit is now completed in many cases by the grounding in your house. And if you're not careful with the interrupting of that grounding in your house, you can be completing that primary circuit of the 2300 volts. And 2300 volts with reference to earth can appear across all the appliances in your house, and that's not good. And so that's something to worry about. By way of a clamp-on ammeter, you can test for this. You can find out how much current is flowing into that that third lead of your three wires coming into your house. You can find out how much current is flowing through that third lead. You can find out how, with a clamp-on ammeter, you can find out how much current is flowing through your water pipe. And in my particular case, that current through the water pipe must have been fairly substantial, obvious by the fact that for the first few years I lived here, before a better grounding system was established, my water pipes were developing pinholes. The current flowing through those water pipes and the potential difference between it and the water was eating away the copper in my house and some of my copper pipes in the basement. Way back in the very beginning when I moved here 40 years ago, they must have developed about 10 pinholes. Over to you for any further comments on this one, Joe. WB2HRO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Did you see with a comment?
Okay, just one moment. What I would say, the utility company is using the earth as one of its leads. That's why the problem can exist. So actually, it's doing the one side of the line is the earth versus the fire. Anyway, on the station, WB2HRO.
Somebody's waiting long enough, David.
Okay, who's waiting, Eric?
That long. Nobody's waiting that long.
Okay, I think it was HUC. I had some further comments. He's the man who asked this original question. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Dick, I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. One, you know, out here on Long Island, PSC territory, distribution is at 13 volts. That's primary to ground. So that's the potential that you would see. The second thing was, let me let it drop. Second thing is, I heard somebody say about inadvertently tying the neutral to ground. That is a requirement. You are required to bond the neutral to ground at only one location, and that's the first means of disconnect, the first overcurrent device that comes into the residence. That's all. That's not an inadvertent thing. That is required. And lastly, let me let it drop. You are required to put the, if the meter is in the basement of the house, you tie the equipment electrode conductor on the ground side of the shutoff valve, but you are required to install a bonding conductor of the same ampacity across the valve and the meter.